This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Coming up next is The Wheel. Here we go. Welcome to The Wheel. I'm Rebecca Chenelou, your local voice in the international movement to bring death out of the closet. I'm very happy to have you here to join the conversation as we consider the mysteries of living, dying, loving, grieving, and honoring our dead. This show is about creating community, so please be prepared to share your thoughts on our Facebook page at The Wheel Mysteries. Go ahead and pull it up. Or if you don't have Facebook, get out a piece of paper to write me a note. Before we get started, let's thank some of the underwriters who make this show possible. The Wheel is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Friends of the Arts, a state local partner to the California Arts Council. Since 2001, Deborah Lucero and Friends of the Arts have been creating economic opportunity through arts and culture, producing community festivals and events including Arttoberfest, the True North Tour, the NorCal Jazz Festival, the Salmon Festival, and more. To learn about Friends of the Arts, visit friendsoftheartsupstate.org. And by Northern Star Mills, serving the North Valley with farm, garden, and pet supplies since 1898. Northern Star Mills offers natural and organic soil amendments and fertilizers, as well as natural and holistic pet supplies. Northern Star Mills is located in downtown Chico, across from Bidwell Mansion. Thank you, Friends of the Arts and North Star Mills. And welcome back to this episode of The Wheel. It's Halloween. It's Samhain. We're coming up on Dia de los Muertos, the Day of the Dead. It's the time of year in many traditions when the veil is thin between this solid world of flesh and the world of spirit. Tonight, for this American death, we'll be hearing stories told by local friends of mine, people you might know. people sharing experiences of times when loved ones were able to be felt or heard even after they had died. What a mystery. I'll also be in conversation with Malama McNeil, a local hands-on healer and my cohort in much of this work around befriending death. We'll talk about traditions and practices that honor the relationship with our dead, with our ancestors, and we'll also talk about how those of us with no tradition can explore practices of remembering and honoring those who've gone before us to the other side. I'll also be sharing news of local upcoming events that you might want to attend, an exit tip for your exit plan, and a song by someone who died in the month of October. We hope you'll plan to stay with us for the whole show, but if you miss any part, the show will be in the archives at kzfr.org for about 2 weeks. As always, your comments and shared experiences are welcome at The Wheel Mysteries on Facebook, or you can email me at rsenoglu@yahoo.com. Changing our death-denying culture into one that is more able to have important conversations about end-of-life stuff is the primary goal of this show. One way that I think we can each help contribute to this shift is by telling our stories. Throughout the ages, our stories have helped define what we believe and who we are as humans. Stories about dying and death and what might exist beyond this life help us sort out what we believe and help prepare us for the one experience every single one of us will have at some point. The experience of leaving this life as we know it. When I asked people on Facebook if they had stories about experiencing the presence of loved ones on the other side of death, I didn't know what I'd be getting into. What I found is that although the storytellers did not talk to each other about their experiences, the stories had common threads. Perhaps death is not as mysterious as we thought. Perhaps if we talked more about it, we could see that there are comforting similarities amongst our experiences. Perhaps instead of being taboo, we would find talking about death to be helpful. I could go on and on, but instead I'm going to let the stories speak for themselves. And since it's Halloween, we will start with the closest thing that I have to a ghost story.
This is Corla Bertrand. I've been a resident of Chico on and off since 2001, and I'm currently the program manager at the Iverson Wellness and Recovery Center. My story starts in 1978, the time I was working 250 miles north of the Arctic Circle, way up in the Arctic in Alaska, and I got a call that my father had passed away. I was very close to my father, and this was really distressful. And back in the 70s, or at least how I grew up, we didn't really talk about death. I mean, I knew my father was in ill health, but I was totally unprepared for his passing. So I made my way to Reading to go to the funeral, and then about a week later, I was back in Seattle where I had a home, and I was very depressed. I was waking up every morning at 3 o'clock on the dot, and one morning I woke up at 3 o'clock and I noticed that there was a light on out in the hall, and I thought, gee, that's really weird. I know I didn't leave the light on. And then I realized that the light was moving into my room. And it was my father, and he sat at the edge of my bed and essentially just told me that everything was okay, that he was okay, and I just felt his presence and love, and it was so comforting that I quit waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning. I know that this experience is recorded in a book, One Year to Live. There's a chapter about how this happens cross-culturally, I mean, all over the world, And essentially, the message is the same, that the person who's passed is okay and everything is good. So I find these kinds of experiences very comforting. I mean, over the years, I've had a number of different experiences, some bidden, some not, where the veils to other worlds and other realities have thinned. And I'm very accepting of that. It's been a huge part of who I am. So I'm not sure of the year. I think it was 1977, 1978. I was up in Alaska, and I was being visited by a distant cousin of mine. And we got up in the morning, and my cousin was visibly upset. And so I asked him what was going on, and he said that he'd had a dream, and that his brother had come to him in the dream and told him that he had decided that he wanted to join their parents, and their parents had been in a fatal plane crash in Puget Sound a couple of years prior to that. And his brother said to him that not to worry, that everything was great. He was going to be with their parents. So we went out to breakfast, and he processed some, and we got back home, and we received a call from his family that his brother had passed away in a freak logging accident over on the coast of California. And interestingly enough, this kind of experience seems to run in my family. I've had the experience, and I also heard stories from my mother about how she had been visited by a cousin of hers that she was very fond of during World War II, and he came to her in a dream and told her that everything was all right and that he loved her. And then a week or a couple weeks later, they found out that he had been shot down in the war. So I was happy to get the call from Rebecca that she wanted to hear my story, because it's something that I don't share very often, because I think that for the most part, people don't really understand it unless they've had a similar experience. So they want to negate it, or, you know, say, gosh, that was an interesting coincidence, or are you sure you were awake? Or, you know, even if it was a dream, what makes you think that wasn't just, you know, something that you ate or some kind of response that you're having in your life? But those kinds of experiences are really special, and they're part of our heritage as human beings. And our ancestors, I think, were much more comfortable talking about them and honoring them, sharing them, than we are.
I love these stories. I love that without my prompting, Corla mentioned that across cultures, people have these experiences, these visitations that let us know everything is okay. It's not that bad on the other side. I love how she admits to not telling these stories very often because people try to explain them away. It reminds me of one of my stories. I was in my 20s, camping on a strawberry farm in southeastern England, where there are a lot of ghosts from past wars still wandering about, and the women in the strawberry packing house would talk about the various ghosts like old friends. I saw old Charlie down at the mailbox. Oh, I haven't seen Charlie in a long time. That sort of thing, you know. And we were camped right next to an old church graveyard. And one night, around the fire, some of the travelers were trying to scare me, the naive girl from America, by saying, "Oh, I think there might be ghosts around here. I think I've heard some ghosts," or whatever. And as I was walking back to my tent, my friend Desmond called me over, and he said, "Don't listen to them. Let me tell you, if you see a ghost, you don't think you saw it, or maybe you saw it. I saw my dad walk through the wall into my room, and it was as real as the chair I was sitting on." His dad had been hit by a bus and killed. And I get this sense when I hear these kinds of stories. People who tell them know they're real. It's just a matter of not sounding crazy to everyone else. Let's hear two stories from my friend Trudy, who shares about her family's experiences. One happy story and one horrific story. Here we go.
Hi, this is Trudy Duesenberg, and I'm 73-year-old filmmaker living here in Chico with my husband. I live in the Orchards and listen to this radio station all the time. Okay, well, I'd like to tell you a story that involves my mother, who in our family, we always considered her a sort of a good witch. We grew up with many fairy tales all the time about mermaids and fairies and good witches, not so much bad. And over the years, I think she tried to prove us to us, even through the Ouija board. I mean, she really was a medium. She waited until we were a little bit older to let us in on that part of her, but she did. But she was also a very scholarly person. She did a lot of research. And so this was a conflict with her, and she was always proving to herself that what she was hearing and receiving from the other side was true. And so I'll tell you one story that how she did that. There was a funeral in town, and I came from a very small mill town in upstate New York, and funerals were always big occasions for everybody. And open casket, and people always remembered how people looked and dressed. And this was a elderly mother of one of my mother's friends. I think my mother must have been in her late 40s by then. And she had gone to the wake and observed her friend's mother, open casket, and she could see her friend was very distressed at the loss of her mother, very upset, and my mom felt really badly about it. But that night, the friend's mother spoke to my mother and said, "I know that my daughter is not accepting this. She's very distressed and upset and sad. And Janice, I want you to be able to tell her that I'm fine, you know? Now I'm with my husband, and everything is really quite wonderful. I'm in a good place. Please let, you know, Dottie know." And my mother said to the spirit, how can I prove this? You know, people just don't believe me when I give these messages. I need something that can prove to her that I've actually had this communication with you." So the spirit mother said, "Okay, I'm going to tell my daughter, go into my bedroom, into my high chest of drawers, and in the back of the top, there's a small hidden drawer that she's kind of aware about. Direct her to go to that drawer, and what she finds in the bag in that drawer is hers to keep." My mother said, "Oh, okay, I will do it." And so she called her friend, and she relayed the message. Of course, the daughter was startled and taken aback that my mother did not share this. This was not a well-known thing in town, obviously, but she felt it was kind of her duty if she could make people feel better. So the daughter was distressed, was startled, and didn't want to accept the news, but my mother directed her to the drawer. She went into the little drawer, and in it was a velvet bag with heirloom earrings that were for her. And then she was happy. She knew my mom had really somehow had a communication from her mother. So that was usually how it went. My mom would ask for a way for the person receiving the information to get a confirmation. This really upset my father, and we were all strictly forbidden to ever tell these stories outside of the house or outside of the family. It was a very conservative Christian community. I have another story about my mother, and probably the last as far as speaking with spirits from the other side. So it was a winter evening, and my mom was at home alone in the house with my dad, and he woke up. It was the middle of night, I want to say between 2 and 3, and he woke up because he sensed my mother was very upset, and she was pacing the room, wringing her hands, and he said, "What is it this time?" And she said, "Somebody I know is in great distress. Somebody I know is maybe hurt, needs my help. I cannot focus. I don't know who it is. Maybe I should call Lynn and Trudy." And my father was like, "If you don't know what it is, if you can't, you know, maybe it would alarm them to just call in the middle of the night. You know, can you you know, walk it out. And my mom really did. And she was really weeping. My dad had never seen her this upset. And she didn't call us. And she just suddenly stopped. It was over. She was exhausted. She went to bed. She was still a speech therapist in the school district. She got up and went to work the next day. And the principal immediately called her into his office and sat her down very somberly. And he said, "Janice, I have very bad news for you this morning." And my mom said to him, "Ellen Van Asdell is dead, isn't she?" Of course, he was a little surprised. And he said, "Yes, she was murdered last night." This was very, very upsetting to my mother. It distressed her so much. She just wept. This was her childhood friend. They had gone kindergarten through grade school, high school, and they both went to Syracuse University together. Ellen was widowed. Her husband had died about a decade earlier. But they were really good friends. And my mother's feeling was, I failed at this, you know, whether it's being a clairvoyant, a medium, she often called herself a vehicle for the message. She felt she'd really failed and she hadn't focused because Ellen probably lived six blocks away. And she felt if I had focused, maybe your father could have gone and saved Ellen's life. She was a high school guidance counselor and she had opened the door to a troubled high school, a male high school student who was very troubled. And he went in the house and he stabbed her to death. But Ellen was also kind of a cat woman, and she had like 20 cats of various ages. And so that week was very upsetting to this small community. She was very beloved, very hard on my mom. My mom got a grip, and kind of by the end of the week, she called Ellen's sister and said, "What can I do to help you?" And the sister said, "Oh my gosh, my biggest problem has been getting rid of these cats and finding homes for all the cats and kittens. Do you know anything about her kittens? Because there's the youngest one will not eat anything." And my mom said, "You know, I remember seeing that kitty, but let me think about it." So, of course, she hung up and spent some time alone and asked Ellen, you know, "Ellen, can you tell me what it is?" And so Ellen did tell her, you know, it was an unusual food. You know, it wasn't tuna. It wasn't cat food. It was something very different that she chopped up and gave to this kitty that nobody would have thought of. So again, my mom said, "Gosh, I've got to think of a way to give this to your sister." You know, because Ellen's saying, "Well, tell her I'm with Ed and I'm so happy we're together. And I'm not at all uncomfortable or sad. I'm in a happy place." And so my mother said, "Well, I'm going to try to do this so that everybody's happy and not scared." And she told the sister, she said, "You know, I feel that your sister really is happy. I have had a dream and I feel like Ellen is with Ed and she's at peace and she's not in pain and they're together. And oh, I remembered what she told me that little kitty would eat." And she gave her this unusual magic formula. Sure enough, that was exactly what the kitty wanted to eat. And so that way my mother felt she had calmed the family, made the family feel better about this horrific murder. And she'd proven to herself once again that she'd gotten the message right. However, she also declared to her family, to my sisters and my brother and my dad, "I'm never going to do that again. I'm going to shut myself down for receiving these messages because that failure was so horrific and so awful that it's over. It's done," which my father was very, very happy about. It was sad. We all felt sad. We missed that about our mom, and she never did it again at all.
So again, we have these reassurances, even when death has been horrific, that on the other side, it's pleasant and it's going to be okay. How many of you have had a similar experience or have heard stories like this from your friends and family? If we talked about it more, we might find that these stories are quite common. And although they are hard to explain, they are also hard to dismiss. Our last story comes from my friend Adrian, who shares a different kind of experience, yet it is one that's similar to what I've heard others share. Are you curious? Of course you are. Here we go.
I'm Adrian Parker, and I grew up here in Chico. I was actually grew up in Durham until I was six, and then I moved here to Chico and grew up here, left for a few years, and came back. I am a licensed marriage and family therapist here in downtown Chico. So, my mother, Yvonne, she bought her first home when I was in the fifth grade. It was a simple three-bedroom with a little yard that was mostly grass with a couple of old shrubs and an old almond tree that eventually needed to be cut down and dug out. And my mother, she always took on and accomplished chores like that on her own. After leaving my grandparents' home when I was six, we had lived in rentals, and I do remember my mother always growing zinnias in the summertime. They were bold and colorful and almost as tall as I was. That seemed to be the extent of her gardening skills. But once she had a home of her own, her green thumb grew, and she really became the consummate gardener. She was a single mom, and money was pretty tight when she was still raising us kids, so she didn't have a lot of extra to spend on plants. But whenever she did have some, we would head out on a Saturday morning to one of the nurseries. We would peruse the aisles of greenery, her dreaming and making plans in her head, and then she would gleefully pick out her new plant to take home. One by one, she would plant a shrub here, a tree there, a rose bush, some ground cover, until over the years, she became the steward of this lush garden of dogwoods, tulip, and Japanese maple. She had dozens of rose bushes, azalea, ajuga, gardenia, daphne. I wish I could name all of her plants that created this fragrant, flowering paradise. She loved her garden and spent hours tending it. My mother died in 2012, almost 8 years ago now. And although I had always identified myself as a renter, she left me just enough money for a down payment, and I purchased my first home, a simple three-bedroom with a little yard and a lot of grass. I really wasn't much of a gardener up until that point, but having my own home afforded me the opportunity to hone my own green thumb, and I started digging in. I will never forget the first time my mother visited me after her death. I was in my backyard on my knees with my hands in the soil, and there she was. That sweet, grounded, earth and plant-loving woman, her energy channeling right through me. She filled me, and I became her. I cried. I sobbed, really, because her presence made me realize how much I missed her. And many times, over the next few years, she would appear like that. Always when I was outside in my garden, her presence would fill me, and then her energy would channel out of me, helping me to create my own lush garden paradise. I'm touched by my mother's generosity, her willingness of heart to always help me, to not judge me, and to love me unconditionally. The truth is that we couldn't have been more different. I was her shadow child, and we always had such divergent tastes, which you can clearly see in our gardening styles. My mother's being neatly pruned and manicured with nary a weed, while mine is wild, unruly, and free, although, to be certain, not free of weeds. And yet, there she is in my weedy garden, helping me and still loving me. And you know what? The older I get, the more similarities I notice between my mother and me. We are truly alike in many ways.
Thank you, Adrian. Thank you, all of my storytellers. Thank you, listeners. And I know some of you have probably experienced that before, just the presence of a loved one being near that you can't really explain, but you know it's there. We're going to have an interview in a little bit, but first I'm going to read another thank you to our underwriters. The Wheel is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Burchard Construction, specializing in custom remodels, new home, and commercial building. From foundation to finish, Burchard Construction, where the homeowner's input matters, assuring a professional, reliable, and quality result. Custom construction with beauty and function. Bids and consultations by calling Adam Burchard at 864-5427 or visit burchardconstruction.com. And by Feather River Recreation and Park District in Oroville, offering a licensed preschool, dance and senior fitness classes, martial arts, sports, facility rentals, and more. Current programs include adult softball leagues, youth after school sports, youth gymnastics, and cheer. Visit FRRPD.com or call 530-533-2011 for more information. You know, I ran into Peter Ratner here in the KZFR studio when I was preparing for this show, and he turned me on to a song by Mary Gaucher, and it's so good, it could be another theme song for this show. It's called Wheel Inside the Wheel. Now, don't worry, she's still alive. I'm saving my song by someone who died in the month of October for the end. But let's listen to a little bit of Mary as we prepare for our interview.
The parade of souls marches across the sky. They're heated light bathed in blue as they march by. While the All-Stars play, when the Saints go marching in, until the second line forms, they wave white hankies in the wind. Satchmo takes a solo, flashes his million-dollar smile. Marie Laveau promenades Oscar Wilde, and Big Funky Stella twirls a little red umbrella to the beat as the soul parade winds its way down Eternity Street. Souls ain't born, so don't die. In the streets at sundown, spy boy meets spy boy, big chief meets big chief uptown.
All right, now we'll dive into our interview for the evening. I have my friend Malama McNeil in the studio, and I want to welcome you, Malama. Thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so
thanks for Mary Gaucher. Oh yeah, favorite of mine.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah. Good. Yeah. Well, you know, we could talk for days here on KZFR about the stuff we've done and the things we think about. But let's begin by talking a little bit about your background with Maladoma Somme. I think that'll also be a good introduction into one culture's relationship with their ancestors.
Yeah. So what comes to mind right away, I worked with Maladoma with a group. We were studying Into the Heart of African Shamanism, which was a pretty sexy name for some pretty deep work. But the kind of culminating event was a trip, actually, to Burkina Faso, West Africa, to Maladoma's home village and compound, where we found all the teenagers of the many families who live in close proximity. You know, it's kind of a little village within the village. They hang out on Maladoma's father's grave, which is built above ground. Or I think he's in the ground, but his bones are. And up above that was this kind of, you know, park bench structure that was all tiled. It was very fancy because he was an honored leader of the community, of the family. And that was the place where the teenagers hung out, was on Papa's grave. So that's one clue that there's a real different relationship here. And later, after that trip, I was exposed to something of the flavor. We were trying to make an American version of a ritual that happens sometime in the first year after a person dies amongst the Dagara, which is a final send-off to the land of the ancestors. Apparently it takes a while for some of us to kind of revisit the places that we loved or the places that we regret not having been fully present to, cleaning up our messes and or just taking leave of the places where we've maybe done pretty well. I certainly can't judge the dead. And I didn't know the people that we were personally, and in a way it didn't matter that I didn't know the people that we were ancestralizing, is what we called it. And it's actually a 3-day process that mimics the 3-day process of a funeral amongst the Dagara. While we were in Burkina Faso, we heard the most incredible keening sound in the middle of the night. A young woman had just received word that her father, who was not well but not dying as far as anyone knew, had in fact died in the night. And a phone call or a runner came to tell her. And that was the immediate response, a sound that I knew was human and didn't know how to make, couldn't imagine how it was made. That sound could be heard in the next village over, and was pretty promptly replaced by the sound of the bellophone, the kind of bamboo xylophone, which played then continuously for 3 days, calling everyone to the site of a death and the site of a funeral. For the elaborate leave-taking and disengagement of all the earthly connections of the spirit of the ancestor. Prior to that, our relationship with our 16 Americans who were there, our relationship with the ancestors of that land had been in doing ceremony, doing some ritual. Always the ancestors were invoked at the beginning of the ceremony. And when we did ceremony at the ancestral shrine, which is where the sort of power object that represents the person who has been ancestralized goes to reside, that shrine was opened while we were there. It was an occasion for some remembrance or something, and the ancestors were invoked, and I was made to understand that the man who was saying that invocation was calling on his ancestors by name
23 generations back. This is a relationship that is just unknown in my experience, and real impressive in ways that I wanted to know more about.
Mm. Yeah, and it's great that you got to go there and actually experience it. Right. And I think particularly having the person die, and I've talked to others who've experienced death in Africa, and our friend Kelly Patterson, I think, was, you know, just, you know, people here don't get it, and people there so get it. Maybe it's, I don't know. You know, you've also been tending the ancestor altar for a Native American ceremony for these past many years. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that and how you got drawn to it, how it feels similar or different from what you learned with Maladoma?
Yeah, I don't know, similar, different. Since my experience of working with Maladoma and the ancestralization, the whole issue, the whole prospect of my ancestors actually being available to me and there being some potential for relationship or some relationship began to just kind of tickle at my curiosity. And the Native American ceremony that I partake in several places at several different times during the year is referred to as the Naraya. It's the dance for all people from the Shoshone Great Basin people's tradition of a round dance, a circle dance. Holding hands, we move in a circle around a tree, a living tree, and a fire and other altar items. There's a buffalo skull involved and a bundle which holds prayers and sacred objects. And also at the center of this circle that is moving in a clockwise way while singing very, very old songs, kind of haiku in the Shoshone language. One we sing is Paiute and one is Lakota, but the rest are Shoshone. Is an altar of the beloved dead. And it's referred to as the ancestor altar, but I've come to understand more that it is where people bring memento objects or often pictures of their beloved dead, their grandparents, their parents, their companion animals who've no longer with them, members of the community who are no longer living, and they're placed there with as honored guests, as it were. And the altar is usually decorated and quite beautifully, if simply. And since we dance at night, there's lots and lots of candles, little tea lights that are lit so that the light flickers over the faces of the beloved dead who look out. And it's the, even though there is a small ceremonial fire, the ancestor altar is often the brightest spot in the circle. I'm just coming back. We danced last weekend in the dark of the moon, and the ancestor altar was definitely the brightest, you know, point anywhere in the night.
What is your experience of being in there with that altar?
It's as if I hear them sometimes. It's as if I get a whiff of personality, and then I'll sometimes just check that out with the person whose beloved it is. We offer various forms of smudge, mostly juniper lit over a coal so there's smoke, and we'll offer that. Sometimes I hear a real call for tobacco smoke, so I light up a not filtered cigarette, don't inhale it, get a mouthful, and, you know, blow it in where I think I'm hearing that from. This dance just over, I heard a call for sweetgrass. It, you know, I say I heard, but it's some kind of body, the whole body senses it, something. It was almost like I could smell it before it was lit. And I've learned that that's how I communicate with them. There's a kind of presence that makes itself known to me. And then I give it, you know, English language.
It reminds me of Adrienne's experience of feeling it kind of in her, not in words spoken so much as just a feeling.
Well, and I was reminded by her, in her story of I had been called to go and help my stepmother sit with my father as he was in a nursing home, and he asked to go home with hospice, and they thought, I think they thought they were going to have a while. So he went home on Monday, and I was traveling down on Tuesday, pretty early in the day, to help her, you know, to spell her, to sit by the bedside. I was a hospice volunteer for years with Enlow, so I thought I knew how to do that. And I wasn't too far from Stockton, which is where he lived, and I felt him go by, moving fast. Going the other way.
Wow. So you knew.
Checked the time. Mm-hmm. And then when I got there, she said that he had just stopped breathing at about that time. Yeah.
Corla had also said that, you know, there's a feeling that our ancestors knew more how to pick that stuff up than maybe we do, you know, and so I appreciate that you as a modern person driving a car, you know, felt that. And maybe we can move now into this work of Daniel Fors that you've been learning lately from Daniel, ways that ancestor honoring and connection can happen to people without any specific tradition. I just want to say a little bit about Daniel. It sounds like he's a fascinating guy. I wish I were studying with him. He's got a PhD in psychology. He's a licensed marriage and family therapist. He credits teachers in earth-honoring traditions like European pagan, Native American ways, Mongolian shamanism, West African traditions. And I resonate with his crediting, this is a quote, the remnant and returning traditions of my older English, Irish, and German ancestors. Mm-hmm. That'd be me, your basic white American, Heinz 57. Mm-hmm. So what can we learn? What have you been learning from Daniel?
Well, you can study with him because he does online courses. He doesn't travel around much. I did have the pleasure of doing an intensive weekend study with him. And the much can be learned. One is that act as if the ancestors are present. Hmm. That, you know, they're in something that isn't local time, but they're not gone. And as soon as you just kind of say, well, you know, suppose that were the case, you can get as much evidence that that is in fact the case, that things happen that, you were just thinking about it that way, and then it's almost like the universe arranged it for you, or was that the ancestors? Many ancestors... cultures where there's, you know, intact ancestor reverence would say, well, of course, that was the ancestors. They can influence our lives. And it's difficult. Another thing I've learned, you know, working with Daniel is that it's kind of, it can be hard for Americans, for those who've descended from Europeans, Western Europeans in particular, not to think that that might be problematic. and especially those of us who don't have an intact ancestor reverence or even intact, you know, belief systems, faith systems that give us a context for, well, you know, they were here and here's what we do when they're not here anymore, and then they're
there.
It's like we're dealing with these troubling spirits without an instruction guide.
Absolutely. And they are,
or they can be perceived as troubling.
Yeah. Yeah. And they can be perceived as troubling, and they maybe are troubling when they haven't actually been given their exit plan.
Mm-hmm.
and supported on their way out. The West Africans say that they need our tears to float their boats across to the other shore, and the land of the ancestors is on that other shore.
I love that the tears are okay.
Yeah. My Cherokee teacher also, you know, says the same, you know. Tears and or song is needed to move them to the other side camp.
So this, when we talk about practices, when we talk about things we can actually do, what I'm hearing is crying, mm-hmm. singing. Mm-hmm. Are there other practices that that you have learned that
prayer.
A non-tradition person can? Yeah, prayer.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Well, prayer in that we have an intentional conversation. We state a message from the heart to unseen recipients.
Hmm.
You know, we pray to a higher power that we trust is there. We talk with our ancestors because we trust they're there. And different order of prayer, perhaps.
Than what some people are used to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mostly the prayer I would have is, you know, gratitude.
Mm.
Gratitude for dreaming me into being, because without my ancestors, I wouldn't be here.
Exactly. Yeah.
So send the, you know, gratitude back up the line, or, you know, back down the line, or whatever direction it is. It's non-local.
Yeah.
It's multi-directional.
And for people who aren't maybe as familiar with prayer, something that we do in bereavement groups is we write the person a letter. You know, the idea
exactly.
that you could write it.
Exactly.
This actually leads pretty well into the next question, which is, how does all of this inform the Befriending Death event coming up at the Women's Club tomorrow, November 1st? It seems like that might be a place where people can explore some of these things if they've never tasted it before.
Yeah.
Tell us what to expect.
Well, if you've been to Befriending Death events that Rebecca and I, you and I, have put on, it won't be like them, except that we will have a central altar of remembrance. This is something that I created with my friend Heather Springer. Immediately after the campfire, we have 86 candles on a beautiful quilt that friends from my round dance community presented to me, holding their prayers for our community. And I said, this makes an altar cloth. And we will have a table set up for people to draw, to color, to do in a kind of visual imaging of perhaps what it is that they're feeling, that they're grieving for, or that they're remembering with love that's no longer really present to them. Something that our dear friend Lorna Kingdon once said, you know, when I listen to people's stories of grief, I hear love stories.
Hmm. Yes.
And I can't hear any griefs, even the, you know, the grief that expresses itself in anger or real terror about what if more of that happens. I hear the connection that they are no longer in the same relationship with. So we also have an extraordinary sculptural vessel that was created after the campfire, which is just simply called the grief vessel, which is meant to receive people's love notes. Again, maybe writing out something, maybe just naming it, maybe drawing a little picture, putting someone's name on it. These messages will not be read. You can release them into this vessel. When the vessel looks like it's about to be full, we will burn them.
Mm.
And then the ash will be put back in the vessel to continue. This is meant to be a sort of permanent grief carrier.
For our community. Yeah. Well, yeah. Thank you, Malama, for... I'm not involved this year, and thank you for carrying that on. You know, Malama and I have had Alliance events for several years now, and we've decided... 8 years. And we've decided to lay the Alliance down, and it will be Death Cafe Chico will still happen 4 times a year. The Wheel is got a lot of it... energy around it, and Malama's moving more into doing these different grief events that mm-hmm. you'll hear about along the way. But if you wonder where our monthly events at the library are, it's because we're pouring ourselves into other things.
We're singing it across the river.
Yes. So, you know, I want to thank you, Malama, for being here. I wonder if you might share with us, there's a poem that you've read before that I absolutely love, and I love that you wrote it. Would you mind sharing that with us tonight? Maybe if you can find it. Well,
it's right here.
Okay. All right. Here we go.
Last wishes. When I die, gather in morning light, bring flutes and drums, food, poems and prayers. Share with one another. Mention my name. Sing simple gifts and all the verses of Amazing Grace. Hold one another weeping while you laugh, remembering we came together in times of levity as well as love. Forgive my going so soon. Linger all day at the edge of the sea, then walk into the hills I loved. Watch for the circling birds of prey. I always thought I'd soar with them, given a chance. Believe I've come to that, and to standing with the oldest tree deep in the forest, to sighing with the wind, to sprouting up with rain-born winter grass, and to shining in the brazen light of a moon pregnant with all we cannot know in one brief life. Gasp then or later in delight at lying down in the arms of those you hold most dear, and let your hearts break then with remembering me and how I loved life. Not loud, but deeply. Not long enough, but all the time. Choose to live then closer to the moment, and more simply. Smile the way I knew you best. Bless each day, each place, each wondrous being, saying, now, so be it. Thank you. Saying, yes, even this. Amen.
Oh, that's beautiful. Thank you, Malama.
Thank you.
I need to hear that at least once a year.
Okay.
So, folks, I'm running out of time. Every show I try to leave you with a tip or an activity for your exit plan, and this is a call to action. If you've enjoyed the stories you've heard tonight, I encourage you to look for opportunities this week and throughout the year to share stories with families and friends about experiences beyond the veil. It's also the time to remember, so I invite you to do something to honor those who brought you into this world and who have gone before you to the other side. You can create an altar in honor of your ancestors as simple as one candle and a couple of pictures. And let me know how it goes by messaging me at The Wheel Mysteries on Facebook. This is the purpose of this show and my passion for it, to get death out of the closet and into our awareness so that we can be better prepared for dying and more awake while we are living. In closing, I'll tell you there was a good article that came out on PBS.org this week, News of the Movement. It's called To Die Well, We Must Talk About Death Before the End of Life. Thank you, Kathleen, for sharing that with me. I'm going to post it on The Wheel Mysteries on Facebook. Other big news is that I will be covering some episodes of The Real Issue for Sue Hildebrand as she makes her mighty campaign to become a county supervisor. Next show I'll be covering is on Wednesday, November 20th, so mark your calendar. Plan to tune in. And last but not least, we will reveal our musician who died in the month of October. Woody Guthrie died October 3rd, 1967, when he was only 55. Do you think he was prepared for it? I have no way of knowing. Can't answer that one. I can tell you his body was cremated and the ashes scattered over the sea off the coast of Coney Island, where he once lived. So, Woody will sing us out with Will You Miss Me When I'm Gone. Happy Halloween, everyone. Thanks for listening to The Wheel right here on KZFR. And remember, friends, talking about death won't kill you.